This week, in our continuing Founder Origin series on Zen Founder, Sherry talks with Andrew Warner of Mixergy. And as far as I know, no one has ever dug into his past and his upbringing and what has shaped him as an entrepreneur like Sherry does today. If you've been online at all over the past several years, you're probably familiar with Andrew's work. He built Mixergy up from basically just another interview show into one of the most prominent and the most well-respected entrepreneur interview show that exists. In fact, after Drip was acquired last year, I did almost zero interviews about the acquisition, but I went on Mixergy because it's just such a mainstay in our community. As you would expect, Andrew has a fascinating origin story. And hope you enjoy the conversation that Andrew and Sherry have as they dig in and unpack what brought him to where he is today. I'd also encourage you to head over to zenfounder.com and enter your email address so we can keep in touch with you. We have an in-person event that's going to be coming in the fall. It's going to be very small and handpicked, and pretty sure it's going to sell out before we get past the mailing list. Sherry's also talking about forming new consulting groups here in the next couple of months. These are remote, very small groups of founders who are getting together and, you know, pushing forward collectively in the struggle to grow their businesses and stay sane while doing so. And it just allows us to kind of keep in touch and let you know the interesting things that are going on with Zen Founder and Zen Tribes. And we don't send very much email. So if you're at all interested in hearing from us, I'd encourage you to head over to zenfounder.com and enter your email.
We plan to talk through the issues faced by startup founders and the people close to them.
That overused phrase, work-life balance.
It is an amazingly focusing time.
This is what we do, you know, aside from our families, this is our whole work life.
I am also known as Dr. Wine.
You know, this is a little bit non-traditional.
A little more zen in the startup life.
Those days were a mental struggle.
I have been stressed in the past, and I know that I will be in the future.
A founder and his or her significant other will both get value from the episode.
I think my first question for you, I mean, you essentially at this point make your living by helping people tell their stories. And I guess I wonder why you think personal stories are so important. You've spent so many hours interviewing people. Why does that matter?
My parents always had people over to the house Friday nights, Saturday nights, Sunday nights. They do cards for friends. I hated their friends. They weren't bad people. They were just annoying people. They would have dinner conversations around food instead of interesting topics that I was curious about. They would do the same old, like, so jokes about, so how's your girlfriend, when I was 11 years old. It was just like, that's not the life for me. And as soon as I could escape the table, I would go downstairs into the basement that wasn't even finished or anything. And I would sit on a folding chair in the middle of an empty room and I would read books. And at one point I discovered business biographies. And until then, I kind of had this entrepreneurial instinct, but I didn't fully know. And then I discovered business biographies and I started to see the world of possibilities. I started to see that Malcolm Forbes used to get in freaking hot air balloons and cross the country and like set records for the fastest way to cross. And you'd read these stories about guys like him who would do that. And was he gay or wasn't he gay? Or was he gay and just kind of living his life, but also being heterosexual? Nobody knew. But here's the thing. He kind of, like, I was going to say thumbed his nose at the world, but maybe gave the finger to what you thought about it. He used to cross the country, as I said, in the fastest balloon possible. But he had this train of people essentially following him on the ground and in the air. And people would say, hey, it's unfair. You're basically using your money to beat everyone else. And he said, yes, that's the point of my magazine. You could do anything you want in business. It opens up these doors. We're not limited by your rules. So I would read these stories of people who are really living their lives, and knowing that upstairs for me was a room full of people who are going to ask the same question about whether I like my rice green or yellow, with vegetables or with a little extra oil and butter. And I go, this is not my life, the upstairs. This life of stories, this is what I want. And it opened me up to all kinds of ideas, opened me up to saying when I graduated from school, I don't have to get a job. I could just go and be an entrepreneur right away. And I know that it's weird to go through college, to aim for grades. And I did. I graduated magna cum laude, or whatever, summa cum laude, whichever laude is the highest.
The highest laude. The best laude.
Yeah, the best laude. I had the most laude. And I'm not too embarrassed to admit that I had to go to professor, forget her name, and say, look, you gave me a B+. An A minus would get me over that hump and I'd get the most laude. Would you do it? And negotiated with her until she finally said yes. So I'm not too proud to admit that it took me a lot to get that. But I didn't want to use it. You can't use it as an entrepreneur. No one's going to buy from me. No one's going to work for me because I had more laude than they did. So I still said, you know, this is a weird thing to do. It seems a little dangerous, but I'm coming from a perspective where it's not dangerous and I'm going to start a company. And when you get exposed to stories like that, they dig inside of you. They become a part of who you are. I know I do interviews with entrepreneurs and a lot of people take notes. I like that they take notes. I'm a note taker too, but I think they'd be surprised by how the structure of the stories that we tell, by storytelling in general, how much it just sticks to you and you can't get rid of it. So they don't have to worry about the messages sticking with them. They just will come through the way that stories about Malcolm Forbes, a boy that stories about his father, B.C. Forbes, who in many ways was more interesting, and tons of other entrepreneurs stuck with me.
So those early entrepreneur stories were the contrast to the boring dinner parties that your parents had, and you wanted to live in those stories. And it sounds like you are living in that story, but you also are telling that story over and over with different entrepreneurs, different conversations.
I am, yeah. It's also my way of learning. I bought the CDs that Tony Robbins used to sell on infomercials, and I listened to them, and he has all these assignments in them. And I don't know that I ever finished all 30 CDs, but I got pretty far with them. And frankly, they didn't help me that much. But I remember he also had this interview series, and I said, screw it, I'll buy the upsell. I'll buy the interview series. And he had this collection of interviews. Some of them were pretty crappy and useless. But one with Jay Abraham stuck with me. And I still see to this day, people are trading bootleg copies of the Jay Abraham interview with Tony Robbins. And one of the things that he said that he recommends to business people to do is, he said, I don't remember if it was once a week or once a day, but he said on a regular basis, find a business person who's completely outside of your world. And just talk to them. Tell them what you do and how you solve problems. Ask them how what they do and how they solve problems. And really just let yourself learn from them. And I thought, I'm going to do that. Everyone says they're going to do it. People are going to listen to this and say they're going to do it. I'm going to do it. And I never did. I had a greeting card company. We had the 12th floor of the 575 building in Manhattan. Up and down that building were businesses that I could have studied from, that I could have gone in and said, I'm up on the 12th floor. I rent the whole thing myself. We're like each other. I want to know more about who's in our building. Can I sit down for coffee with you? Can I just pop in? I'm sure they would have loved it. I was an internet startup. They would have loved to find out what this internet startup was. I didn't have the guts to do that. I didn't have the time to do it. Didn't have the momentum to do it. Now I get to do that on a regular basis. I think I learn a lot from it. And I know that they learn a lot from it too.
So you've painted this picture of yourself as somebody who, at least as a kid, would go in the basement, separate yourself from the irritating, boring adults, and sort of read books and kind of dream about what the possibilities of life might be like. I don't know, maybe say more about who you were as a kid. What kind of kid were you?
It depends. I feel like we go through different stages as kids. There was a period in elementary school where I had a lot of friends and I liked my friends. Then there was a period in high school where I just couldn't relate to people. I remember that we would sneak beer off and drink it. And I thought, who cares? My parents gave me beer when I was 3 years old. It's not that big of a deal. I just don't want to sneak off and drink beer. What I got really fascinated by was like some random stuff, but nobody would want to talk to me about it.
What were you fascinated by?
I get suddenly fascinated by the Beatles and have to listen to every song that they had and discover how great it was. I get suddenly fascinated by the early Motley Crue album and have to just find someone to talk to about it. No one got it. I remember more specifically getting into two things, Republican conservative politics, very borderline libertarianism, if not over that border, and business. And I just want to go and sit and talk about that and read about that and start a little company. And nobody cared about either one of those. Nobody cared about them. And I get it. I feel like the Republican stuff just kept getting all kinds of arguments. I would constantly get into arguments with people, and I feel like I was telling them why they were wrong, and I was proud of my arguments, but at the same time, I said, it doesn't really matter. What do I care if Jonathan in high school is persuaded that I am right about the true form of government. He's not going to do anything with that. And even if he does, one extra person, it's not – the benefit to me is too small versus ruining a relationship with someone who I'd want to be friends with forever. But I would ruin that relationship. Jonathan wants nothing to do with me. It's totally fine. I'm not hurt by Jonathan not doing it. I'm hurt by myself saying, hey, you see that this is actually not helping you. Why do you have to keep yapping about it? Then the other part that I thought was helpful was studying business. I would read the Wall Street Journal every chance that I got. And it was so weird at first to read the Wall Street Journal. It's like, who are you to pretend to be a real business person like these guys? You don't even know what a stock is. But, you know, I read it and I would learn. I would read books on direct mail marketing, you know?
This is high school. So this is 15, 16, 17.
Right. Yeah. And I think the stuff that other people were into, like sports, I couldn't get into it. I would try. A lot of the business books would even say, I would read business books for women and they would say, pretend you like sports. And they would teach you how to pretend to like sports. And I say, I could do that. All I have to do is read. I love reading. I'll just read the sports section every day. And I couldn't do it for 2 days straight. So yeah, that was the fascination.
It's a pretty unusual developmental trajectory. You know, so much of what you're supposed to do as an adolescent is figure out how to be in relationships with other people, like form your identity, usually through relationships with your peers. And it sounds like you formed your identity somewhat in isolation.
Yes, but books got me into it. Books got me to the group of people that I thought were really my peers. I didn't think the idiot who was trying to score a beer on a Friday night and pretend he was cool because he was at a party, I didn't think that guy was my peer. I thought he didn't even know himself. I thought he didn't even know why he was there. He was doing it to kind of be able to show off to himself, if no one else, that he was drinking beer. Whoop-de-doo. Wasn't even getting drunk from it. So it's not like you can say the high of the beer was actually doing something. They were sipping their beer like, I don't know, like proper British ladies who drink tea, right?
It sounds like you had, at that age, like a really unusual perspective of the future.
Yes.
I mean, you got the game that high school is not everything. Like, you figured that out. It was innate to you. And then you were already kind of planning for and living your adult life.
I was. And you know what? Today, I think that would be a lot more acceptable. Today, because entrepreneurship is so celebrated, I think some people might be going towards it, even though it's not really for them. But today, you go into school and suddenly luck of the draw. If you're an entrepreneur and like at heart, you'll find people who talk about entrepreneurship nonstop. Many of them are just posers. They pretend that they care about it. They pretend they know about it. All they really want is a quick score. It's not who they really are. And so today, if you're artistic, maybe you're the odd man out who feels like a loser because what you'd like to do is actually be in a band. And what high school kid anymore dreams of being in a band? If anything, they want to be the sole rock star like Beyonce. They don't want to be like Destiny's Child, right? They don't want to be like Motley Crue. I think the bigger thing that I had to accept from that is, who am I? And forget all these other people. And you can't really find... You can't hope that the school is going to drop you in with a room full of people who get who you are, because no teacher understood and respected my need to be a business person. If anything, growing up in New York, you're really surrounded by the very liberal agenda, which is business is bad. By the way, I'm completely apolitical now after having gone through this after going through this Rush Limbaugh stage. Even when I met Rush Limbaugh, I was too nervous to shake his hand, to give you a sense of how far I'd gone in that direction. But it wasn't supportive. Meanwhile, it's very possible that today, if you're into music, I don't know what the school system is like. I have a 3-year-old now, so maybe I'm going to discover it in the next few years. It's very possible that if he's into music, they're gonna laugh at him for being into music. Do that in your spare time. I don't know, but I do know this. They randomly throw you in with a group of people who then are your surroundings. It's very hard to bust out of your surroundings. And the way that you could do it is by opening yourself up to people who are doing the things that you feel more connected to. And if you can find that thing, you are so freaking lucky. I used to think everyone should find it if they could just get serious and spend some time with themselves, they would know exactly what they're about. I don't think that anymore. I think if we are lucky enough to know what we are into, if we're into music, if we're into art, if we're into business, if we're into athletics, if we found that thing that we are lucky enough to be into, I think it's totally worth sacrificing everything for it. Most people don't know who they are, don't know what they want. It's a tough thing to do. And if you are lucky enough to do it, you can't ever lie to yourself. I could never pretend, hey, you know what? I never wanted to be an entrepreneur anyway. I better go and just go do this other thing. I couldn't. I'd like to. There are times, frankly, when it's so hard that I think no one else is going to know. I'm going to say that I'm going to go take this job over here that's kind of a boring job that I could just like chill out in. No one's going to know, but I would know.
You would know.
I would know.
Did your parents get you?
I do think they did, yeah.
And they were able to sort of support you becoming who you were. They didn't stand in the way or block you becoming who you needed to be.
I think so. Thankfully, I come from a Middle Eastern family. There isn't this tradition of going to college. I was kind of weird for going to college. And frankly, I probably shouldn't have gone to college. I do think they got me. I think that I was so serious that if you met me, Sherry, I would have beaten you over the head with who I was. Like my personality when I walked into the room would have told you in 10 seconds what I was about. And if anything, I had to like go to therapy to learn how to chill that out a little bit, you know, to not be so much me.
To let other people have a personality in your presence.
No, to adjust my personality to them. So I always was comfortable letting other people have their own personality. But imagine like I'm here, I'm ready to talk business, Sherry. Then I go out dating at 29 when I finally say, you know, work's going well, but this other part of my life is not. I start dating. What the hell do I talk to people about? How do I understand when somebody tells me at dinner that what she's really interested in is world travel? World travel? Who the hell cares about world travel, lady? Go get serious and work. That's what I would say in my head. Actually, I would accept that that's who they are, but I wouldn't accept that I would want to travel. So imagine you're going to dinner with me, or my girlfriend would go to dinner with me, want to travel, and I can't accept that I'm going to learn how to travel because all I want to do is go to work or go do something else. I had to learn how to do that. I didn't even like feel comfortable dressing for non-work. I would go to work in suits, and then when I thought it was casual, I would wear khakis, a button-down shirt that was tucked in. No one's fucking me in like that, right? I had to go into therapy. The therapist looked at me and said, look at how you're dressed. And I said, I'm dressed down, lady. I got khakis. She had to say, no, actually, you're not. And it took me a while to understand it. So I had to learn how to like be more like the people around me so that I could be more with the people around me.
Was there a single moment or experience that led you into therapy?
Yeah, I wasn't dating. I really said, you know what? This is a part of my life now that I want to explore. And I went out there to try it and it just didn't work right. Didn't work right. It's a very challenging thing to do. I always thought, you know what? I get rich enough, the solution will come to me, right? I get rich enough, I'm going to dress well. I'm going to be at parties. Someone's going to dress me. That's how I'm going to dress well when I'm rich enough. I'm going to go to parties and people are just going to know that about my business success, right? Look at Sumner Redstone. I've never heard the guy really speak, but he's not really the most dashing looking guy. He's not the most like charming looking guy. He's the guy who ended up running Viacom, CBS. He bought those companies and so many others. Paramount he bought. But look at the women who you ended up dating and marrying, right? The women in his life. So I said, you know what? I love Sumner Redstone. He's a hero of mine. He focused on his business like crazy. He became successful. The relationships happened. Well, I said, all right, I'm successful. Where the frick are the relationships? And they didn't come. And so that was something that made me finally say, let's go into therapy.
I need a relationship expert to help me out.
Yeah, right. I got a team of them because I go out and I get like all the resources I can all together. The only thing I didn't do is go to the pickup artist guys. That was not me.
You just needed the therapist and the personal shopper. And
yeah, I got the personal shopper. I spent like $25,000 on one shopping experience with this personal shopper. Boom, everything's dressed. Now I've learned I don't even care about that.
Well, now you have a wife, right?
She does not want to dress me. Actually, speaking about clothes, what I ended up doing after going through therapy, so I got the personal shopper, Catherine, I can't remember her last name. I got her. She took me out. And what's cool about a good personal shopper in Manhattan is, first of all these stores that you go to, you don't realize there's a next level in those stores. Like maybe you go to the Armani store and you look around and go, this is beautiful. What you don't realize is there's another section of the Armani store that you're not allowed in unless you're like the next level up client for them. Once you get in there, they bring you champagne. You don't have to pick out the clothes. They bring you the clothes in there. They dress you. They tailor stuff to you. You just are sitting and enjoying yourself. And if you're comfortable with someone looking at you with your underwear, which I wasn't, then you're going to enjoy the experience. I wasn't comfortable with them all looking at me in my underwear and bringing clothes in and out for me. So I would keep going behind the curtain like a scared little girl. And then I would come back out with my clothes. But then what happened was I went to LA. Is this like helpful at all? Is this what you're going for?
Go for it. Hey, I'm interested. All right. I'm a shopper.
I feel like we're just like chatting here. I hope this is helpful for somebody. Then what happened was I went to LA and I said, every night 6 out of 7 nights, actually, I'm going to push myself to go out and talk to people, talk to women specifically, and just see what happens. And what I discovered was, as I just went through all these experiments, it wasn't the clothes I was wearing. It wasn't any of that. It was just, do I feel comfortable with myself to start a conversation? It wasn't even about having the ideal lines or any of that. It's just, do I feel comfortable with myself in a conversation? If I do, I may not take someone home. And frankly, I was not comfortable just taking random people home, but I would at least be able to strike up some relationship every night with someone. And maybe it leads to good friendship. And some of them ended up at my wedding. Maybe it leads to dating. Maybe it leads to something else. And so what I learned was the clothes that I thought were important weren't. The success that I thought was important to it wasn't. It was being able to have conversations, being able to...
Your mindset was important.
Yeah.
And the clothes helped with that, it sounds like,
yeah.
Or at least got you started on that path. It sounds like you practiced a lot.
Yes.
Do you remember the moments of being afraid that you would fail?
Yes, I do. I remember in business or in...
Either way.
I'll go relationship with you because I think relationships actually help power up my business, help me force myself to work. Yeah, it was around kissing. There was a girl I was dating. I was in high school and we didn't kiss and she thought I didn't like her. And the reason we didn't kiss, I knew in my head was I'm worried that I think I'm the man, but I'm also kind of scared. What happens if I kiss her and I'm a bad kisser and she's going to talk about how much of a bad kisser I am, or she's going to see that I'm a bad kisser, right? So I didn't kiss her because of that. There are little things like that that happen in my life that don't seem like that big of a deal, but they are.
Well, you were afraid of being seen, of being found out for potentially not being good at kissing.
Yeah.
So it was better not to do that, not to do it, better not to take the risk.
Yeah, exactly. And I didn't explicitly say that to myself. I think if I would have explicitly said better not to take the risk, I would have pushed myself to take the risk. I'm not aware of it. I wasn't aware of it. I think you did an interesting episode about the voices in your head. I think what's interesting about them is I obviously have them. We all do have them. Some of them, I think some of us have pictures in our head, like pictures of disaster or pictures of greatness or pictures of whatever. That's how we think. Others think through voices. I know that we all have it differently, but I don't think that I was aware that they were there. And when I would hear people say we all have voices in our head that are guiding us, like our mom's voice saying, go out there with a sweater, or dad saying you have to be more aggressive, I would have thought that's for idiots and for psychopaths. I didn't recognize that that's the way that I was thinking too, that that stuff was in my head, and it was. And so there I didn't recognize it. I think I also didn't recognize it. So after I had this business success, but I also wanted to run my company, this greeting card company that I had in my 20s. I wanted to run it for the rest of my life. Look again at Sumner Redstone. I don't mean to use Sumner Redstone as my ideal hero entrepreneur. I think if anything, like BC Forbes and Malcolm Forbes were much more so. Back when Forbes was like the thing, it changed the way that people thought about business. But I forget what I was going to say about Sumner Redstone. I started falling in love with like BC Forbes all over again in my head and Malcolm Forbes.
Well, you were talking about how you weren't aware that you had this sort of set of voices in your head. You wanted to run your company for the rest of your life.
Right. I want to run it for the rest of my life. And when I couldn't, when it just couldn't keep growing, and I sold it to everyone else, it was a success to me. I knew it wasn't like a big financial success from the sale. The money came from profits in the business. Thankfully, we had profits. But when it was time to close it, it wasn't a huge exit. And I didn't even want a huge exit. I wanted to stay on forever. And that was the first big failure in my life in the thing that mattered to me. And anything else, if I failed, I thought, you know, but I'm really good at business. I've been studying it forever. If you believe in yourself, if you work hard, you can do it. And then I had that failure and it really rocked my world. It just changed my perception of business. And I didn't realize how much when people said that I was successful, how much I clung to that self-definition, how much I clung to that. All right, this is who I am. They always saw me that way. I definitely want to be seen that way. What happens if I launch something and I fail? What happens if I launch a next thing and it doesn't go very well? And so there was another place where I was definitely afraid.
And that wasn't really a possibility in your head until that point, until you had to sell the company.
Right. I really did grow up listening to the self-improvement gurus who said, like, without a doubt, as long as you believe in yourself and you really see the vision, you will make it. And especially those older guys, they had this belief that when you want something and the world says no, you should just keep going after it because that's how you succeed. There's a story that Napoleon Hill used to tell the author of Think and Grow Rich, where he was working with a salesperson who wasn't closing enough sales. And so he gave the guy one of these like horns that I guess at some point people used to put up to their ears when they were deaf or hard of hearing. And he said, whenever you try to sell someone, if he says no, put it up to your ear and say, I'm sorry, I can't hear you, but let me tell you a little bit more about why you should buy this life insurance. And he did work with a life insurance company to help them, their salespeople. That was indicative of how they believed you need to continue. As long as you don't hear the no, you will get to the yes. As long as you believe in yourself, you will get there.
And that's not always true. So how do you say it now? How do you think about yourself now in that success failure category?
I don't know that I consider success failure. I do consider like living up to my vision of myself versus not. And I do think that I'm not living up to it. I want to definitely be a lot bigger.
What do you mean bigger?
Bigger. I'd like much more money than I have. And my wife asked me the other day, well, how much? I said, I always will want more. And she said, really? You'll always want more? And then she knew to drop it, or she thought that she should drop it. I don't think she should have. I think I'll always want more, for sure.
What's the point of more?
So she dropped it, and then she said, all right, let me share what I would like. And she said, I'd like to travel. And she talked about traveling. And she and I both love traveling. And in my head, I thought, well, how much traveling is enough, Olivia? Like, if you travel to 10 cities this year, will that be enough? And then can you finally drop this? Not finally drop it. Will you quote unquote finally drop it? How about if you do it for the next 5 years? There is no enough. You always want to see another place. You always want to experience more travel, right? If she reads a book every night, I would never say to her, well, how many books are enough, Olivia? She'll always have a book going, always, always paper, never digital, never Kindle. Like once in a while, she'll have to read a book. She'll do Kindle. So same thing with money, more.
The money isn't about the number. It's the experience of getting it.
And the number. I like the number.
Okay. You like big numbers.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't even like doing stuff with it. It's just kind of a fun thing to pursue. Sure. So I definitely want more of that. I want more fame. I don't like that I've been doing interviews. And I love that when I'm in San Francisco, people know my work. I love that people who I sign up for their software will suddenly say, no way, Andrew. I'm a big fan of your work. But I have to be honest with you and say that that's not enough. I'd like much more attention, much more recognition. I like all that. I want it all.
Is that what it would mean for you to be really living your life?
No, I think I'm pretty set there. I'm really living my life.
Okay. And that's where we began, you know, your reflections on your parents' friends and their conversations about food that were just so boring, and the sense in which like maybe they're sort of wasting some space, wasting some oxygen.
You know, let me tell you something more about this more stuff, this mentality that I have. I was just on a call with a group of entrepreneurs who came to me for some help. And one of them said, Andrew, I need to just finally launch a site. I said, how much is it going to cost you to launch it? And he said, well, I've got a friend who's going to do it. I said, if you had to hire someone, what would it cost? I said, $500, but I have a friend. We're chatting right now. By the end of the day, because I talked to you, Andrew, you lit a fire under my ass. I'm getting it done. I said, how much would it cost you? He said, $500. I said, what's your email address? He gave me his email address. I PayPal'd him $500. I said, now you have belts and suspenders. Go to Upwork if that's where you think you're going to get for $500 a website. Go and get that site up. So now he has two different approaches to get the site up. One way or the other, he's got to have this thing up so that he can continue his pre-sales. After we got through that conversation and he stopped beaming at the way that I responded, he said, Andrew, how do you keep yourself motivated? How did you do it back in the old Bradford and Reed days? And I get it. He's in a good position. He's a smart guy. He's got a good job. He doesn't need all this agita. He doesn't need to keep pushing himself to have two different nudniks out there trying to build his site and demanding more stuff from him. And right, he doesn't need that. So I said, my answer was, I got in touch with everything about myself, including all the things that I didn't have and I wanted. And I think we're supposed to pretend it's okay. I think we're supposed to look out in the world and see that there's people who are in Paris and that we know, forget about like wanting to be like everyone else. No, we'd like to go check out Paris. We'd like to go and hike the, what is it called? Annapurna Circuit or whatever it is. We know that we'd like to do this stuff, but we don't give ourselves permission to want it because we're not supposed to. Just be happy where you are is what we tell ourselves.
We want to protect ourselves from disappointment.
Right. And from feeling like I want all that and I'm not there. And so look at how much my life sucks or how I'm not there. So I told him, I like to get in touch with who I'm not and what I want and really be bothered by it. So I'm comfortable, perfectly comfortable saying to you, Sherry, that I'd like more attention. I'd like more money. I'd like to fuck a lot more. And I'd like to have more time with my kids. Not in that order. Is that okay to curse like that?
Absolutely.
All right.
Which order would you put them in?
The kids are kind of separate. I didn't think that I would enjoy spending time with younger kids because what do they do? Swing? What the hell am I going to do swing? Oh, I love it. I love it. I took the day off 2 days ago to just go be with my three-year-old. We went to the indoor playground. Do you know the stuff that gets these guys riled up with excitement? Going to an indoor playground. It's great.
And usually it's like the pieces of small rubber that are at the indoor playground, at least for my kids.
What is?
The little pieces of like small rubber that are on the ground
right,
of the playground.
Play with that.
Like
right.
It's not even like the swings or the tools. It's like the dressing.
Oh, that's fantastic. And by the way, I love that it's all rubberized. It makes me feel better. A three-year-old apparently can climb up to, if you let them climb a freaking building, they climb a building from the outside, right? At least in the indoor playground, everything is rubbery. Everything is soft. Yeah. So I want more time with them, especially now at this age, because I could actually blow their minds with like indoor playground. Come on. How great is that? I want it all.
How do you deal with the space between what you have and what you want? What does that space feel like? Is it angsty? Is it driven? Are you calm about it? I mean, what's the emotional quality of the gap?
It's a little bit of all of it. I think for me, it's a little bit of all of it. Sometimes it's definitely angsty. Like, really, am I going to end up at the end of my life with not having gotten all this stuff that I want, all these achievements that I want, all these experiences that I want? And I think it's actually not bad. If I end up just like this, I think it's not bad. I really enjoy my life. I really like feel like I've at least attempted. Here's what I think about with that. When I was, I think it was senior year of high school in Brooklyn Tech, they said anyone can be student body president. I was really into politics. So I said, this is an opportunity for me to learn about politics. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to apply. I even took like whatever class they wanted you to take to learn about politics or about like civic duty. And then you can run for president. I ran for president and I lost. I lost big. And I didn't just lose big, but I think I came in fourth place. But I went and told everybody that I wanted them to vote for me. Even Jonathan, who didn't like me, I said, hey, would you vote for me? I went and I asked them all. I put signs up all over the school to the point where they told me to take it down. And I remember when I failed, I humiliated myself by showing everyone how much I wanted it and letting them all say that I didn't do it. I remember how proud I felt. For once in my life, I went all out without any fear of failure, without any embarrassment. I do not look back on that experience. I said to myself then, and I say to myself now, saying, I wish I had done this one extra thing. I did not look back and say, I wish I had the guts to ask my friend Henry to vote for me. I do not look back and say, I wish I had the guts to put up a poster in our social studies class. I just did it. And so the feeling of even failure at that point is so much better than the feeling of success in other places, to know that you've given it all. There's a Vince Lombardi quote that I don't remember about leaving it all out on the field and how it makes you feel. That is what it is. So when you say to me, how does it feel? It feels good. It feels at times like really painful in my stomach. My stomach churns over the last few days, especially because I'm taking on so much. It feels sometimes a little bit scary. It feels sometimes very exciting. But overall, I want to feel like that kid who gave it all to try to be class president, even though he didn't get to be class president.
You're proud of the effort. You're proud of the guts that it took to do that.
Yeah. Imagine to not look back and say, if only I'd done this one other thing, right? There aren't a lot of experiences in your life where you could say that, right? I started this company back when I was in school that did, this teacher who taught the SATs. There was this guy, he was so good. He gave you he taught you the good stuff, the stuff that would take forever to learn. But he also would teach you things like, hey, look, they're going to tell you that you need to figure out a way to measure this triangle. Let me show you how you take the corner of a piece of paper off of your sheet and use that for a ruler so you can quickly, like he had all these quick tips. So I said, imagine if this guy just gave somebody who was kind of like hard up, a little scared that they're not going to hit their numbers, give them just an hour and a half of just those tips, just those things. That'd be huge. I'm going to create the cram session for the SAT. If you want to cram an hour and a half, this guy's going to give you all the techniques. So I made an agreement with him. We were going to split the money. I was going to go get people for him because I sucked at the SAT, but I love business. And I went out there and under the cover of darkness, I posted signs all over the bus stops near the high schools. I must have been in high school at the time, trying to get people to sign up for this thing. I did it at night. I didn't talk to people. I was too chicken to actually put myself out there with this. And all I got were people who were just kind of calling the number, seeing that it was voicemail and hanging up because I set up a voicemail number on it. That's the way that I don't want to go down. I'd rather go down like the kid who tried to be class president and wasn't, than the kid who wanted to just sell SAT cram sessions and couldn't even like go and talk to people.
How do you relax? I mean, you're an intense guy. Like, what is recharging look like for you?
I am kind of intense lately. Recharging used to be reading a book and just kind of relaxing. I can't do that so much. I speed read books now because I've learned to read books fast. Didn't you do a session on speed reading? I didn't get to listen to it.
Oh, yeah. He just did one about how to get the most out of books, but I wasn't part of that. Go ahead.
So because I do interviews with authors, I've learned to read really fast and prepare fast. And so I do that. I just don't get that much out of it. What I do to relax is I like to run long distance. I like to cycle. And now that I have kids, I don't want to be away from the kids for a long time. So when they go to sleep, I take a bike in the backyard. We're so lucky in San Francisco. We have a nice size backyard. And I have a bike with a smart trainer. I attach the bike to the smart trainer. The smart trainer then connects via Bluetooth to an iPad that I attach to the front of my bike. And I use an app called Zwift. When I cycle fast in my bike, this character on Zwift cycles fast. So if I have like an hour of downtime at home or an hour and a half, my wife knows I'm out there, I'm watching some stupid thing and Zwifting like crazy and trying to get up the mountain in Zwift as fast as possible. My fastest King of the Mountain, if anyone's out there listening and using it, is 39 minutes. So I'm not super fast, but that took a lot of effort. I'm very proud of it.
What happens in your mind when you're cycling? Are you thinking? Are you planning? Are you scheming? Or are you off?
A couple of different things. It's either vegging out and watching something like House of Cards, or I say, I actually can push myself to do 150 watts right now. That's the way they measure output. I can push myself to get to the top of the mountain before Olivia calls me in because I need to do bedtime with the kids. You know what? If I really hustle up on this thing, I can actually get to the top. And even though the Tron bike, which is what they give you if you do like intense miles going uphill in this thing, it's kind of smart that this app even tells the smart trainer, this guy's going uphill. So it's harder to get up a hill on this world. Smart trainers are so smart. So I do say, you know what? I think I could do it. I think I could push myself a little bit further than I thought. I think I can push myself to a higher level than I thought. Or I just kind of lose myself sometimes in the virtual world of it, you know? Not so much like as when I cycle. When I cycle, I definitely will spend way too much time looking around, which is why I never finish fast. I will spend a lot of time looking around, kind of cycling and getting lost in my audiobook.
How has being a parent changed you?
In a lot of different ways. It forced me, when my first child was born, I knew that I wouldn't be able to spend as much time on work and things couldn't collapse as often. And so it forced me to systemize my company, to turn it into a real company and not just a thing that I did. And that gave me a lot of free time with him. I mean, he and I spent a lot of time just walking through the neighborhood. I've changed so many diapers. I have no issue with any of that. He can cry. I see parents get uptight about it when their kids cry. I just love it. Bring it on. I'll do something goofy and he'll love it. So I got a lot of that from it. Then when my second child was born, I started to think about, this was about 9 months ago, I started to think about what would happen if I died. In a weird way. I never had this fear that all these parents have, which is what happens if the baby dies in his crib. I knew he'd be fine. And if he would, no baby monitor is going to save them. And everyone worries about it. So I'm not going to worry myself about it. I could feel comfortable letting them stay in bed, leaving them there and coming and getting them there. Where I started to worry was, what if I die? And it's that Malcolm Gladwell book, that latest one that he put out there that got it in my head. He talks about how many successful people had fathers who died. Specifically fathers, really interesting. And he said, this actually can push a kid to extreme levels, but also it could be incredibly damaging. It's such a traumatic thing for a parent to die. And that reminded me of Jeff in my elementary school, whose dad died. And people, I remember a specific incident where people made fun of him. I was going to say we all made fun of him, but I was an observer on that. And it didn't hit me. Why would he care? So they're making fun of that. They make fun of everything. We all make fun of everything. Who cares? I just kind of took it in from an interesting, why would he care? Not even like putting him down. I'm just taking it in. And he cried because his dad died and someone made fun of him. And it just kind of like stuck with me. And then when I read that book, I thought, that could be me. Yeah, there's a tiny chance that my kid could grow up to be president because of this traumatic experience, but there's a much bigger chance that he could be really scarred and damaged by that. And then what other damage would I end up doing? Like J.P. Morgan, I think, I forget who it was who saw after J.P. Morgan died, he really wasn't so rich. heck, interesting. Like, there's so many things that you could not be able to do. Maybe I don't leave enough money for the family. Maybe I don't leave enough, like, of myself for the family. And so I started to work a lot harder to figure out what I need to leave just in case I die. And I don't mean just money, though money became like such a weirdly needy thing that I wanted to get my will in order and all that stuff.
But you want to make sure that there's enough of you to sustain your kids so that they're not damaged by, or you're minimizing the damage that would happen if you weren't there.
Yeah, it became more dramatic, the concerns that I had. It flashed to, I recently heard an audiobook about Joseph Kennedy and like what a tough womanizer he was according to this book, and he was never at home. But when JFK as a child was sick, he would just go and sit next to him. And I thought, to be able to do that for your kid when everything is going on in his life, to be able to say, yes, it's all going on and I'm very important. And he was important to the economy, to the world, to his businesses. But for him to then say, you know what? It's more important that I sit here with my kid, and to have the freedom to do it, knowing that things aren't going to collapse, was really important. And so I don't want my legacy to collapse if I have to go and spend, who knows, a week, a year, 5 years, like with a kid who's sick. I want to be able to keep it all going. And so all those collections of disaster thoughts came into my head and
changed the way that you organize your business and your life. I mean, the kids don't care how important you are if they don't feel that they are important to you. You want to be able to sit there.
That's never a concern that I've had, that they don't think that they're important to me. The concern is even not so much just like leaving them financially well off is important, but just also we're leaving a legacy now for our kids one way or the other. And it could be a legacy of fakeness that we're putting out on social media. It could be a legacy of really world-changing ideas that we're getting to leave out there. I think that's important, and it can't just disappear.
I mean, this is a question that Rob and I talk about a lot. We are certainly much more financially well-off and stable than either of us were as children. And so our kids are growing up in this life where they've been to Paris, they've spent a month in Thailand. Like, they have had all of these kinds of experiences that our wealth has made possible. And sometimes I struggle with the challenge of how do you then infuse them or just let them go through the struggle of being hungry for something and the drive that comes with that.
You know, one of the only good things that Steve Forbes did for the Forbes empire. So it was BC Forbes, then Malcolm Forbes, then Steve Forbes who came and took it over. And I think Steve Forbes kind of let it all go to pot. And now it's like anyone can put any crap up on Forbes.com. But one of the things that he did was he created a magazine called Audacity. Audacity was about tremendous wealth through the ages, historical wealth. And it did this piece about kids who grew up under tremendously wealthy families and how they were raised. Audacity magazine should be in libraries and should just be accessible to everyone forever. It's just a work of brilliance. And there were lots of different approaches. Everything from we were given everything and we didn't appreciate it to we were given everything and we did appreciate it to we were, there was one girl who said, my parents made us pay for everything because they didn't have anything when they were growing up. And so they had us pay for things like the dentist. It was all great that we had a sense of responsibility, but it sucked when in the middle of the night we worried about how to pay our own dental bills. And so the reason I'm bringing that up is because I know there are problems there and I know there's no easy solution. If these people who like moved worlds couldn't come up with the perfect answer, I'm not going to pretend that I can. I'm not even at that issue with a three-year-old. It's not much of a problem. It's like, do I give him chocolate once a week or once a month or never is the big question that we have. But I will tell you this, even though I can't solve that, the opposite problem is much worse. How many times do you see families fight over money? And even if it's not a fight over money, it's a fight because someone's feeling stressed and the stress is coming back to money, that I would gladly take this problem over the other set of problems if I had to. And this is not an easy problem to solve, right? I mean, frankly, even for ourselves, I realized just this year that when I have any need, I just go to Amazon and I get something and I solve it. Any little need. And I think I could always return it if I don't need it, but I never do. And it piles up. And that's definitely an issue that I have. And so I'm not going to say I can solve it for my kids if I haven't yet solved it for myself. But it's definitely, I don't mean to minimize it is what I'm saying, but I definitely take this problem over the other problem.
Absolutely. So there's some gratitude. What do you feel most grateful for?
That I have a chance to live the life that I really want, the stuff that I really wanted. I used to love the library in Jamaica, Queens. It was the big library. It was in a bad neighborhood, but it was great. It had all the books, it felt like. And unlike the ones in Manhattan, you could actually get access to them. You didn't have to feel like you needed to make an appointment. And it was like meant for scholars. This was meant for you. You get to go in there. And I remember being there one time, waiting for my turn to talk to the librarian and looking behind the sink and saying, can you imagine? This guy's going to have to go and wash his hands after. Imagine he has to go poop. And then he comes back out here, has to wash his hands right here with everybody looking at him because that's where their sink is. That's not going to be me. And then I said, what if it is me? What if like the circumstances of life force me to live things to that level to a point where I'm not happy with it, where you never know what life could push you into. How many people were rich and then World War II came up and suddenly they had to live like in hidden or crappy lives and just be happy that they're alive. So you never know. And I thought, you know what? All these books that I'm reading can't ever protect me from, forget about washing your hands with everyone looking at you after you poop. But some unusual circumstance where your life isn't your own, where your life is forcing you to do things even on a day-to-day mundane level that you don't want to do. And I'm really glad that I don't have that. I actually have the opposite of it. I get to dream it and not live it entirely the way I'd like to. I'd like more, as I said, but at least I get to be the master of my own story, the writer of my own story. And that means the kid who loved reading biographies gets to create biographies. The kid who was dying to learn how to talk to girls or talk to people now feels totally comfortable doing it. I mean, you and I met at Converted 2016. When you sent an invitation for me to come here, you said, hey, we were in bed together with like a little smiley face or something, because we were. It was like you, me, Rob, and I think other people crammed in to the bed in my hotel room. It was a joke for a photo, right? But I felt comfortable suggesting this weird thing. I felt comfortable saying, let's all do this wacky thing. I felt comfortable saying, everyone at this conference, come to my room because we're going to do a scotch party. And I felt comfortable knowing that it's not going to be awkward with just one person or no one showing up. It's not going to be awkward because I won't know how to talk to these people. It's going to be great because I'm going to get to meet new people. And you and I had a chance to talk. I'm going to get to connect with old friends in person again. And I'm going to get to have a fun night, enjoy myself. And so that's it. I'm proudest of the ability to not stand on the sidelines and wish that I got to do this stuff and wonder if I could ever get out of my shell and talk to people, but actually be able to do it.
Not be afraid.
Yeah.
That's a good place to leave it.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to this episode of Zen Founder. Our theme song is A New Beginning by bensound.com, used under Creative Commons.